Good morning. Today is the 31st of May, 2018. It's a Thursday. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History with Robert Bob Cornelius, C-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S. And my name is Tom Martin. This is a interview conducted over the phone. Good morning, Bob. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. Do I have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. This is part two of our interview with you. At the end of our first interview, part one, you were recounting a river trip with the Sierra Club through Glen Canyon in 1963, just before the gates of Glen Canyon Dam were to close and begin a major inundation of Glen Canyon. Can you tell me more about that river trip and about its impact on you, what you saw, what you smelled, what you heard? What do you remember about that?
Well, Glen Canyon was a very, obviously a very beautiful place. I think there was a lot of, it was sort of intimate. You had all of these little side canyons, which they called glens. And each one of them was very unique and very beautiful. For example, even just contrasting from one side of the river to the other, I talked about going into Music Temple in the last interview, and across the river and just upstream was Hidden Passage, and Hidden Passage was a real narrow sculpted canyon, pretty much without vegetation or anything, at least in the lower stretches where I went for an hour or so. And Music Temple was an entirely different place. It was this big sandy beach with kind of dunes in front, and then in back was this gigantic sort of an amphitheater with this amazing acoustics inside there that we talked about, and people would go in there and sing, and it was unbelievable, you know. Someone with a bad voice sounded wonderful in the Music Temple. So just the way it was. Other things I remember, one thing that was very impressive is when we went past the Escalante River, I was kind of surprised in that you had the sheer wall. It came in from the west, of course, but the sheer wall, and then there was just this defile, just a big cut there, and it wasn't very, again, wasn't very wide, you know, but here came this, they call it a river. It was, you know, not huge by any means, but it came out. We didn't stop there, unfortunately. But I remember the to the south, on the south, I think it was the south side of the river along the cliffs, were all these pictographs that had been drawn. And about the time I was looking at those, here comes a big flight of great blue herons by.
Wow.
And it was very, kind of a moving experience there. Another thing I recall, there were several areas where it was more you could see for a distance, and you could see the edges of mountains coming down, probably more as you got toward Navajo Mountain and that area. And we got into a quite a windstorm on one day, rain and wind, and we were talking the other day about things that they talked about around the campfire, and one of the things they talked about was, you know, we're going to have this lake with not a lot of accessible shoreline in some places, and you're going to have these windstorms. And when I came back to Glen Canyon, I found out all about that firsthand, you know, when it became a lake. place that was really interesting to me was Navajo Canyon, where we spent our last night. And it was kind of, the geology there was kind of stair-stepped, and the Navajo Creek kind of came down over these blocks, so to speak. You know, I still have that impression in my mind. Another really interesting place, and I don't recall where it was. Maybe you would remember, but there was a spot where there were these tiny little water-worn rocks that were perched on little clay-like pedestals, and there were thousands of these things in this one area where it was very smooth rock. And I never saw anything like that again until I was at Phantom Ranch one time, and I hiked from the upper stretches of Phantom Creek back across past Cheops Pyramid, and then came down into Bright Angel Canyon there above, mm-hmm. above the campground.
Yep.
And there's one area up there that's kind of smooth rock, and here were all these little rocks that were identical with at least the way they were perched to this these unusual formations.
And they're only a couple inches high, and there's lots of them.
Little tiny.
Yeah.
Just tiny.
Yeah.
I was like a miniature of going over to Arches National Park or some other, Mexican Hat Rock or something
mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
that, you know, only on a miniature scale, and very real intriguing. Moki Canyon was interesting. One thing I remember there was all the quicksand, going up the creek. Gosh, it just sink down. We had fun playing in it, you know.
Right.
But then there were Indian ruins up there, and very lush canyon as far as vegetation. And that's one of the things that was really great about Glen Canyon was all the riverine type vegetation that was in all the side canyons.
What did you see there? What type of vegetation did you see both along the main Colorado and then upside canyon?
The main Colorado, of course, you had an invasion of tamarisk somewhat, just like you did in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
But you had other willows and those types of things. As you went up the side canyons, you could see, cottonwood trees. Redbud is what I really remember a lot. It was the first time I'd ever seen redbud when
nice.
I was there. And they're a beautiful, probably my favorite tree. And then, rushes and reeds and things like that. So it was just unusual. I remember at Moki Canyon climbing up on this rock above camp and kind of sliding down, and somebody saying, well, that's why they call it slick rock. You know? It wasn't a controlled, it was more a controlled crash than
mm-hmm.
The way I wanted it to be. Other things that I remember were just the camaraderie of being on a raft that going down. That's something that's interesting. I'm trying to remember. We had two rafts, two large pontoons. I think they were probably 33 footers, maybe. They
mm-hmm.
were J rigs. Some of the people put, tarps up and things like that when we were having this rain and windstorm, and they had like a flag on one of them. It was kind of comical, but I don't know. You do get, I guess, the same type of thing at Lake Powell, but I always said if you want to get divorced, you go on a houseboat trip at Lake Powell, because there were so many people that had started as friends or even husbands and wives, it seemed like, and by the time they got to Rainbow Bridge, they were arguing and fighting and wanting to go back home and everything. Just something about the dynamics of that whole thing. So,
do you remember the time of year when you did that Glen Canyon trip in 1963?
Right.
The
month? It was in, I believe it was in April because it was spring break at school.
Ah, all right.
And I usually tried to do something, you know, go someplace if I could, if my parents would allow me to go someplace during spring break. And so I went to Glen Canyon in 63, and then in 64, I believe it was, I went to have a supai with the local YMCA from my area.
I don't remember
what I did my senior year. I guess I didn't do anything.
Okay. Still staying with Glen Canyon for just a little longer.
Yeah.
Did you see the river, the water rising? I mean, from toward the end of your trip,
right.
Like the last night, or if did you go on a hike maybe up to Rainbow Bridge and come back?
It did start to rise that last night. We stayed at Navajo Canyon, and that night, I think it was, the water started to come up, and as we went further south on the Colorado there, the beaches were pretty much gone, starting to disappear.
Okay.
And that was really sad, you know. I mean, everybody looked at that and knew what was happening and knew that all that we had seen in the last week was all going to be drowned, or the majority of it was. And so, you know, it was just kind of a sad, sort of morose time.
Yeah.
As everybody headed out.
Did you see any other river groups there at the time? Did you see anyone else down there? In April, it was a little early for the regular
boating season.
One
of the things we saw, this was really kind of crazy, when we were at Music Temple, we saw water skiers. People came up river because the river was in flood because it was spring.
Okay.
And they came up river and were water skiing right in front of the where we were camped there at Music Temple. And I don't know if it was an Art Green tour or something like that. And, you know, I'm thinking we saw other boaters on the river, but I don't remember. That's not something that's real vivid in my mind. So I'm thinking there were very few to speak of.
And then, go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the other things that was kind of interesting about Glen Canyon was the accessibility of a lot of these really beautiful side canyons. It seemed like they just came right down to the river, and you could go in and see places without having to do a tremendous amount of canyoneering, you know, initially. And as the lake waters rose, I think, lake waters rose, things, you know, started to change dramatically.
Yeah.
There was a period of time where it opened up when the lake was coming up. It opened up a lot of area, a lot of country that was probably either inaccessible or very difficult to get to by people that were in rafts from the river. But then as the lake would drop, then you'd have huge driftwood piles and mud debris in front of access points. So when I was at Glen Canyon as a ranger, go up some of these side canyons. For example, Forbidding Canyon. I remember going up there. It goes into Bridge Canyon, or maybe it's the other way around.
Yes, goes into Bridge Canyon. That's right.
Right, and when you got up to the end there, it was just a sea of driftwood, and you couldn't get through the driftwood to access the side canyon because it had all, you know, filled in. And then also you would get that infamous white ring around the lake as it dropped.
Yeah.
But you know, I
Let's hold off on these, if we can hold off a bit on these comparisons back and forth, because I know that you're going to end up at Glen Canyon working for the Park Service, but this is good stuff, but hold that thought. The last question I had about Glen Canyon, but in 1963, you're there with Elliot Porter. He's going to write a book titled The Place No One Knew. My research has led me to see there were an awful lot of people that actually knew the place. It wasn't that Glen Canyon was unknown. It was more that, you know, it was like the Tennessee Valley Authority. This change is going to happen, like it or not. Was there any discussion at that trip, meaning, you know, reclamation had passed the Colorado Storage Act. There were a number of legislative pieces that had fallen together in the 1950s. Now it was the dam was being built. The gates were closed, I believe, in March. So the water was coming up. At that point, can you talk a little bit about what David Brower and Porter were saying on that trip?
What they were doing, what?
What they were saying, what they were thinking about on that river trip.
Well, I really can't read their minds. I know they were, you know, despondent over what was happening.
Okay.
And I think probably frustrated and we're looking at additional judicial things that could at least prevent or slow the filling of the reservoir. That, you know, Rainbow Bridge became kind of the Rainbow Bridge National Monument, and the flooding under the bridge
yes.
became quite a controversy. And for many years, you know, when I was at Glen Canyon, I remember they had set a limit on how high the reservoir, I don't remember what the exact elevation was, but how high the water could come, and it couldn't go under the, could not go under the bridge.
Right.
And that changed when I was at Glen Canyon. But that was kind of the rallying cry for a while, and of course they were afraid of water inundation and eroding the buttresses on the bridge and having it collapse, you know.
Right. How did that trip change you when you got back to San Francisco? We were talking, you said you were a sophomore in high school. Hey, you're a sophomore in high school. Was it just that was a fun trip, or did it affect you in one way or another?
Well, I think it affected me a lot. I became active, at least in finding out information about environmental things that were going on in the country and in the Bay Area. And I remember attending several. I went to a wilderness conference in San Francisco right after the Wilderness Act was enacted, and
1964 passage of the Wilderness Act.
And those types of things. So, and I think I probably things I wrote in school, you know, in classes probably reflected my interest in environmental issues and those types of things.
Okay, and then it sounds like your next outing to heading east off into the eastern desert was to Havasu the next year?
Went to Havasu the next year. I found out that the local YMCA was going to Havasu Canyon, and I didn't have a real, I guess a real, any knowledge of Havasu other than I'd seen a few pictures, looked like a pretty place, and it was at the Grand Canyon, and I had this interest in the Grand Canyon, and I went down and asked if I could go on this trip. trip, and I hadn't been one that had been in their club or anything very much, but I talked my way into this trip, and we were able to go to I think it was a 2-day drive there. I remember we slept in a park in one of the towns. It must have been Kingman or something, overnight, and then the next day we drove up, got up to the Hualapai hilltop early in the morning, and was still right about dawn, and then we headed down into the canyon, and my daughter, who she's now almost 30 years old, she just went down to Havasu about a month ago. It's become the place to go, but when I was there, it was still a little bit undiscovered.
Yeah.
And you would, after you climbed down into the canyon and hiked through the sand down all the way to Havasu, you got there, you went into the local store, the general store there, and you paid your whatever it was, I think it was $7 or $8 to cross the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went down to the campground. It's a couple miles down to the area between Havasu and Mooney Falls there, where the campground was. And that was actually at that time, and even when I worked at the canyon, that was Grand Canyon National Park.
That's right.
It was a real kind of a crazy jurisdictional deal. Where you started out, I think it was in the Coconino National Forest, and then you go into the National Park, and then you go into the reservation, and then you go back into the National Park. And so we camped out, and, you know, it was just absolutely breathtaking. The color of the water down there is absolutely unbelievable. The contrast between the water color and the bright orange cliffs, it just takes your breath away.
Hmm.
But one thing I remember about it was it was in the spring again, March or April, and the daytimes were beautiful, a little bit cool. But at night, it rained every night we were down there.
Wow.
It would just start raining. And the first two nights, I slept out in the rain and just in my sleeping bag. And during the day, I went over and put my sleeping bag next to the fire that they have there, dried it out, and then was stupid enough to do it all over again the next night. The third night, someone mentioned that there were some caves across the creek. So I waded across the creek about time to get ready for dinner and everything, and there were half the group or more were over there in those caves trying to stay dry that night. So we slept in the caves during the night, and then we made two hikes while I was there. One was back to the Supai, near the Supai village. There's a little Indian cemetery there.
Yes, up Carbonate Canyon, that's right.
Yeah, and you can hike up to the side of that, onto the slick rock and up, and you end up on the cliffs above Havasu Canyon. You can hike for miles there.
Right, top of the Red Wall, down, yeah.
Yeah, top of the Red Wall. We hiked down about as far as Beaver Falls, maybe a little bit further, and then another day, and that was the main activity of the trip, was to hike to the Colorado River and climb down through the caves and the cables and the chains and whatnot there, down to the base of Mooney Falls, and then make half dozen or so crossings of the creek down to the mouth of the creek. And that was a really interesting experience. And I remember my clothes turning kind of blackish from the travertine, I guess,
huh?
In the water. Or maybe it was just from the dirt, you know, I'm not changing my clothes. I'm not sure what it was. Anyway, got down to the mouth of the creek, and so interesting to see that turquoise blue water mix in with the brown of the Colorado River, and lots of more quicksand there at the mouth of the creek.
Did you notice a bunch of fish at the mouth there in the blue water?
Did you? I did not. Okay. No. They may or may not have been there, but I don't remember. Is that something you've seen?
Yeah, that's more recently, and that's what I'm asking. I thought, I wonder if that's an artifact that's a recent event.
I don't know. Nothing that I noticed at the time. So.
Okay.
So that was a really interesting experience. One of the really crazy things that happened is the leader of the YMCA group, he was an older man. He'd been down there many, many times. And
his name?
I don't remember his name. It's been so long ago.
Okay.
But when I worked at the Grand Canyon, I spent about 2 months in a ranger capacity down at Supai, because it was still a national park. And my first trip in, I'll never forget, I was just down below, slightly below the village, walking along, and who should come walking up the trail but this YMCA leader. So roles have changed a lot. You know, this is about 5 or 6 years later, and we got to talking, and he said, this is my last trip. He said, it's changed so much. He says, it's not like it was when you were down here. He said, there's just so many people now, and
this would have been 1969.
Everything is just getting terrible down here, just the numbers of people, the atmosphere of the place had changed an awful lot. You know,
that was 1969.
No, I'm guessing. Let's see, 69. Yeah, it was. It was 1969 because it was fall.
Okay.
Let's see. Let me think again. It might have been the spring of 70, because it was, I think it probably was the spring of 1970, because what had happened is they had a spring on the wall there of the canyon where they got fresh water. There was a Boy Scout troop that went down to Havasu, and they all got sick. Now, whether they drank creek water, you know, or whether the water from the spring was contaminated, I don't know. But they put a chlorinator on the spring, or iodinator, I guess it was.
Okay.
And they had to have that serviced all the time. So that was the reason that I was going down there, to be sure that the water supply was was.
Let's hold that again, if we can hold a discussion of when you're in the Park Service in Havasu Park, because I'm going to want to ask you. I've got a couple of names, you know, people working for the park, and what were your duties at the time. There'll be a whole much more discussion about that. But just you walking down there with a backpack with the other YMCA group that you weren't really connected with, led by this older gentleman who knew the place really well. I'd love to know his name and what his history in there was. What else do you recall from that? From that 64 trip, hiked down to the river, hiked along the top. Do you remember the ranger, the name of the ranger there in 64 that was on duty there?
No, there wasn't a ranger. There wasn't I didn't see any Park Service presence down there. There was no, when I was down there later on, there was a tent, and then later there was a little wooden cabin of sorts.
Right.
No, there was nothing down there.
Okay.
And, you went through the village, you paid your $7, $8, you hiked down and sort of free camped around. There were no picnic tables, I don't believe.
Okay.
Because I guess there were. I guess there were picnic tables. There were just very few of them. And I think we just had one for our campsite there. And I think they had outhouses down there at that time. But, you know, it was pretty primitive.
Okay. But beautiful.
Beautiful but primitive, yeah. Which goes nice. Together sometimes.
Okay. So you're a junior in high school at this time?
I was a junior at that time, yeah.
And so you've been in Glen Canyon in 63, down to Havasu in 64.
Right.
This is, I can just think, you know, as a student in your teens, that these would be fairly, the word I'm looking for is, they could be fairly, powerful, parts of forming your life.
Well, sure. Oh, obviously I was really, really into, environmental issues and I practically lived to hike. I mean, at that time, I'd mentioned earlier that I was, you know, had joined the Sierra Club, and that sparked a lot of interest in, you know, environmentalism, but also just getting out. And I know I really struggled in high school finding, and that's always, it's kind of fascinating me. I just struggled to find somebody to go with me on a lot of these things. So that was one of the benefits of the Sierra Club. You had instant friends, you know, by going on these different hikes and stuff. But I really did have trouble finding people to go with me. I finally got about two or three guys that I could, call up on a Thursday night and plan to do something on a Saturday or something like that. And mostly it was, backpack, a couple of backpack trips. I got people to go with me and hikes up Mount Diablo. But I did a lot of solo hiking and stuff.
In 64? 65?
Well, throughout my high school career there, from about the end of maybe my freshman year to my senior year, and then, you know, and then on into college.
Okay. And did you do any other adventures that you recall in 1964, 63, 64, 65 as a senior then in high school? Any other adventures that
I'm trying to remember when I went to, I think I went to the Trinity Alps, but that was a summer. That was more summer, not springtime. I went to Yosemite. I went to, hiked up into the Little Yosemite, 1 year up, in that part of the above Nevada Falls and in Yosemite.
Okay. That was, that solo or with others?
That was with another kid that came along. I had this friend named Donald Holm, H-O-L-M, and he and I went to, did a lot of Yosemite stuff. We did a lot of day hikes around, you know, up Yosemite Falls, across to the North Dome, down Snow Creek, back around past Mirror Lake. That I remember doing that one and going up Glacier Point and down and then let's see. Oh, we did do with another friend from high school, a guy named Scott Stewart. He and I did a high Sierra trip. We went from Tuolumne Meadows up to Glen Allen and way around a place called Return Creek and Crescent Meadow, not Crescent Meadow, Matterhorn. I think it was Matterhorn Meadow. Something like that.
Okay.
And then we ended up down at a place called Pate Valley down on the Tuolumne River. And I remember running out of water. And it was really hot. It was like in August. And we ran out of water about halfway down this 3,000-foot descent or whatever it was down switchbacks. And when we got to the Tuolumne River, we just, you know, threw our packs off and just submerged ourselves in the river to try to cool off and get something to drink. And then we hiked on up Waterwheel Falls and all that area back up to Tuolumne Meadows. So that was a big adventure.
Nice. And this was 65?
Probably 65. I was probably at least a junior or a senior when we did that hike.
Okay. And still without a car, how did you guys work out transport?
Good question. I think my parents dropped us off. I remember my dad took us up to in Northern California there at the Trinity Alps, and he dropped us off at this trailhead, and you know, we basically said, well, we'll see you in a week, you know.
All right.
And we took off, and we managed to take the bus back from Northern California back down to the Bay Area there back home. But when we came down, this was with this friend Don Holm and I. We came out of the Trinity Alps and onto the main highway, and I don't know how far we walked to get to Weaverville, but it was a really hot day. It was way up in the hundreds, I remember.
Oh my gosh.
And we're trudging along the road with our backpacks on, and people are whizzing by in their cars, and this guy stopped, and he was a real old man, probably my age now, and he said, would you boys like a ride? So we said, of course. So we got in the back of this car, and it was an old car, like something from the 50s or something, or even older. And I remember him driving into Weaverville, and it was really unsettling because he kept talking to us and looking back over his shoulder at us while we were having this conversation as we're streaking down the road, you know. As we were going into Weaverville, here goes the Greyhound bus to the east.
Oh.
Well, that was the one we were supposed to be on. So we had to spend the night up in the chaparral above this service station that was also the bus station. And I remember laying in the sleeping bag and some types of bugs, you know, falling on our faces all night.
Oh, geez.
Mosquitoes galore, and it was really an awful night. And then we had to wait the entire day to get the eastbound bus. I guess the bus wasn't due till the next day. That's what happened. We went down, and there was a guy at the station. He was a shoe salesman, traveling shoe salesman.
Hmm.
And we were talking to the Greyhound driver the ticket agent. He said, well, this guy's going down to Redding, and maybe you could hitchhike a ride with him. So we said, well, okay, that sounded like a good idea to me and my friend. And so I sat in the front seat, passenger seat, and my friend sat in the back. And this guy drove like a maniac down the down the highway, and we were scared to death as we went down the hill. I remember we were around a curve, and I was kind of cramped clear up against the door, and he says, "There's no brake over there, Sonny." You know, we just kept going. We finally got into Redding, and then he. We didn't know exactly where the bus station was, and he got really mad at us, and I thought, this is really getting creepy, you know. So
huh?
I said, just drop us off, you know, and we did. We eventually found the bus station and got home. But
yeah, the adventures in the wilderness are much more tame.
Oh, boy, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the wilderness was tame compared to the ride down the mountain, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. So a week-long backpack as a high school senior, that's pretty good. You were still in Scouts, active in Scouts at the time?
I probably was still a little bit, just tangentially, I think.
Okay.
I wasn't doing too much at that time with them, I don't believe.
Okay. And then, so as a senior in high school, were you thinking, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to, you know, I want to study, you know, a certain topic?
Well, I was, like I mentioned earlier, you know, at about the age of about 9, I decided I wanted to be a park ranger. This seemed like a great thing. And so I was always interested in natural history and those types of things and the sciences. And so I, you know, you always had this thing called college prep in high school. So most of my classes were academic and I knew I was going to go to college. I mean, it was kind of a given. My mom, you know, was kind of the academic one in the family as far as my mom and dad, and my dad was the mechanical wizard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't take a lot of like shop classes and stuff like that, which I kind of regret now that I have to maintain a house, you know, and
yeah.
stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Although I'm pretty good at home repairs and stuff because I worked for the Park Service for 33 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, I remember my senior year, I had to go in and see a counselor, and I really didn't know what a counselor was, and I still don't know what they do in high school, to tell you the truth. But this was a woman, and I went in, and she was supposed to help me come up with a decision on where I might go to school or those types of things. And I remember she said, well, where are you wanting to go? And my mom wanted me to go to Cal Berkeley because she had gone to Cal Berkeley, and she eventually got her degree, her master's degree from Cal. In fact, we were going to Cal at the same time. So I'd see her on campus and you know, hiding behind the bush and wolf whistle at her or something. But it was really funny to see your mom on campus with you.
Hmm.
So I, get back to what I was talking about. This counselor says to me, she says, well, she looked at my academic record and everything. She says, I don't think you're smart enough to go to Cal. And I said, oh. And she thought I should go to Diablo Valley Junior College. And and I thought, well, you know, I don't want to go to Diablo Valley Junior College. So I went ahead and applied at Cal. I got accepted there. And, you know, and I did, academically, I did fine. But it's always been surprising to me why she was, you know, so discouraging. But that's life, you know. Everybody. So anyhow, I generally in grade wise, those types of things, I usually did really good in certain subjects, and I did average in others. You know.
What was your declared major?
Well, I started out as forestry.
Okay.
And then I had mentioned earlier, I went up to this forestry camp in Northern California.
Right.
Got sick, had to drop out. After I dropped out, I got a job with the California Division of Highways as a flagman. And I also as a truck driver interviewer. That was an interesting job. And that was all in front of the Oakland Coliseum. And we were building a overpass there.
What did you do as a truck driver interviewer?
Well, the truck drivers would come in, and you would get up on the running boards of the truck, and you'd say, "Hi, I'm so and so, and I am supposed to interview you." And you'd ask them, you know, how many loads they'd done that day, how many hours they'd been working. I don't know, a bunch of questions that the Division of Highways want to ask you, and I'd gotten this job because this Donald Holm, who was my hiking buddy, his dad was an engineer for the California Division of Highways, and he was the head engineer of this project. So it's the old thing, not what you know, but who you know,
yeah.
type of deal. And So a bunch of crazy stuff happened with that. I was talking to these truckers, and most of them were fairly gruff, you know, anyway. And the guy says, "I was interviewed on the last job," and he puts it in gear and takes off. And I'm racing down the highway, you know, on the running board of this 18-wheeler, and I had to jump off in the dirt. And so that evening, when I finished work and went into the office there, I just kind of casually mentioned this to the to the chief engineer that was my my ride home anyway, and he was not very happy with that driver. So I think he got canned or something, but you know, it was pretty serious deal. I could have got killed.
You bet. That's right. Wow.
I kind of lost my train of thought as to what we were talking about.
This is your first year at University of California there in Berkeley, your major was forestry. But as you mentioned, they had the summer camp, and that
I decided. Well, I've got two more years before I graduate, so I've got to find some sort of degree to come up with. So I ended up getting a degree in geography, with kind of a minor in biology, and that was what I ended up with as far as a degree. And I thought, well, you know, I can always teach school or something, it can't hurt me. After all, I do have a degree. So.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's right.
So I ended up going to work at Grand Canyon right after I graduated, and then I had one more quarter. I had to go back and finish up school.
So let's talk about your university training a little bit. You mentioned that you we talked before we started this interview that you ended up in ROTC, and this would be during the late 60s in California. And what was that like?
Well, my dad, you know, the Vietnam War was raging at the time, and you could tell by all the protests and everything else that were going on too. My dad suggested to me, he said, "Why don't you get into ROTC? Because it's better to go in as an officer than as an enlisted man."
Uh-huh.
And which was good advice. My dad always had good advice.
Hmm.
And he said, "If you don't like it after a semester or so, you could drop out, you know, drop the course."
Mm-hmm.
So I went into the ROTC program there, and there was a lot of, you know, polishing of brass buttons and keeping your uniform looking good and lots of parading around and marching, and then there were classroom things. Classroom, they held it in the gymnasium, and in classrooms in the gymnasium. And it was okay, but I it wasn't something that I wanted to do for 4 years. So after a semester or so, I went ahead and dropped out of the ROTC program. But walking across campus, you know, with all the anti-war people and everything, I don't remember anybody ever really giving me a bad time. You probably got a few looks, but no one ever said anything negative or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They did burn down the Navy ROTC building when I was there, and then of course there were all kinds of riots, and I think that was my freshman year I did that.
These would have been the Oakland riots, is that right?
There was more than that. There was always protests, you know, on a daily basis.
Okay.
But there was some real serious riots, and there was the one where they marched from the Cal campus down to the Oakland city line and had confrontation with the Oakland PD and all. And
did you participate in that, or what were your thoughts of kind of what was happening there? I mean, you're certainly interested in environmental awareness and in lands. You want to work for the Park Service. It's been an inspiration for you. and all of this turmoil is happening around you.
I had several thoughts. One was my parents were paying for me to get an education at Cal.
Right.
And that was one of my thoughts. I was kind of insulated somewhat from a lot of the riotous activity that was taking place, because most of my classes were, even in forestry, both forestry and geography, were on the north side of campus.
Okay.
And it would be, you know, nice and quiet there, and there'd be something raging in the Sproul Plaza. The whole Vietnam experience was very confusing to me, you know, as to, you know, why we were over there, what were we doing, and seeing all the images on the national news and everything.
Yeah.
And I really wasn't very politically active. I was more thinking about, I want to get a four-year, get through college.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to go out, get a job, and, you know, have a family, those types of things. And,
uh-huh.
I do want to work for Park Service, Forest Service, BLM, one of these agencies. And that was my goal. And my goal was never to get involved in the politics of the time. I really didn't
okay.
do much of that.
All right. So how is it that you came to be employed by the Park Service?
I my last year as a senior, before I graduated, but the year before, being 1969, I took a first aid class with at Cal, and I think that was helpful to me. I also had. When I was in high school, I had taken a career day, been involved in a career day, and I wanted, a mentor that was involved in the Forest Service or Park Service, BLM, some agency that is in the outdoors there.
Yeah.
And they didn't have anybody. They took me and had me go with a guy who had a lab where they made allergens for for different kinds of things, like if you're allergic to grass, they would synthesize some kind of liquid that, you know, you could use to desensitize yourself against that.
Hmm.
And they said, well, this was the closest we could get to of being an out-of-door thing. Well,
an allergen chemist. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, hmm. Allergen chemist. And he said, and the guy kept apologizing. I said, well, it's interesting, you know. I've got allergies anyway, so this is still interesting to me. After that was all over, it would have been a month or so, I got a phone call at home from a guy that lived just on the next block over. He was the father of a girl named Carolyn Bradshaw, and she was in my graduating class at Pleasant Hill High School, where I went to school. And he introduced himself. He says, I work at the U.S. Forest Service in San Francisco at the regional office. And he said, they told me that you had wanted to talk to somebody about that in the career day. And I unfortunately couldn't participate in it at the time. But he says, I'd be glad to talk to you.
Wow.
Are you available now? And I said, sure. So he came over to my house and we stood in the backyard there talking about jobs in the Forest Service. And one of the things that he said that was really critical, he said, and this is the way it was at the time, they didn't have Jobs USA or anything.
Hmm.
So said, you have to have your application in by the, I think it was the 15th of January or something like that. And even when I was hiring people years later, you know, I would get calls in the spring when people think the job is going to be available and you should have applied, you know, 4 or 5 months earlier. So that was a critical piece of information, and I remembered that when I was a senior in college. And so I put in applications at two parks. I put in one at Grand Canyon National Park as a seasonal ranger, and then I put in one at Sequoia Kings.
Okay.
And I got accepted for both, but the Sequoia one came after I'd already accepted the Grand Canyon position. And I still remember I was in the kitchen of our house, and I got this phone call, and the guy says, hi, my name's Richard McLaren. He says, I'm the chief ranger at Grand Canyon National Park. And he went on and he talked and he talked and he talked. And I don't remember very much of what he said, except he said, would you like to be a, you know, a seasonal park ranger at Grand Canyon? And I said, yeah, of course, you know.
Cool.
So it was really...
was that the spring then? Spring of 69?
69, yeah. I started, and the call came probably, I'm guessing, in mid-May to late May. My EOD date, or the day I could enter on duty date that I had put down, was like the 15th of June. So it was quite late in the season. I'm speculating that one or two things happened. Either someone bailed on them,
right,
or they came into some extra money, and they were able to hire me. So Dick McLaren was really a great guy. He was very calm. He was an old-time park ranger. He was the chief ranger at the time at the park, and he was just a real gentleman. And I years later, I remember going to Rocky Mountain National Park and for some training, and the training was at McLaren Hall. And there was a picture of him and his two brothers, Fred and Bert. And, you know, it was really cool to see that. I remember him telling me one time, he said, you know, Bob, he says, I've never been out of the national parks more than 2 weeks at a time. I've always lived in a national park because his dad was in the park, and then he was second generation park service. And a lot of things happened with his position later on. We can go into that later if you want, but.
Yeah, well, it'll be good to know who was assigned to what that you recall as you go through your accounting. So Dick calls, says, do you want the job? You say, yes, please. Your EOD is the 15th of June. How did you get to the South Rim of Grand Canyon?
Well, there were a couple other things maybe I could talk about first.
Yes, please.
First of all, I had to get a uniform. And in those days, Albert and Ferguson was one of the big, there were two suppliers of uniforms. Albert and Ferguson was in Merced, California. And I was going to mail order stuff. And my dad says, heck, I'll drive you down there. We'll drive down to Merced, and you can get fitted in the store. And I thought, well, this is great. So we drove down one afternoon and just showed up, and it was kind of a small store. It was surprising that they, you know, were a supplier for the whole service, but I guess the service was smaller at the time too. But got all fitted up. They, you know, they hemmed up everything. They actually sewed everything up right there. You
just
know,
tailor made it. Wow,
it was tailor made, and. One of the things that happened is we got ready to choose a tie. He says, now, do you want the clip-on tie? Or I said, no, I want a regular tie. And he says, are you sure you want a regular tie? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, he said, in the type of work you're doing in a big park like Grand Canyon, he said, somebody might just grab that tie while you're talking to him in their car and drive away.
Wow.
I said, I'll take the clip on tie. So he knew enough about issues that were going on in the parks at the time, you know, to make that wise decision. So then to get to the Grand Canyon, it was an interesting thing that happened. I had a 1959 Volkswagen Beetle, and it was sea mist green, just like Park Service painted everything practically, a little different shade maybe. I had it parked in the underground garage near my dormitory at Cal, and you know, I didn't drive the car every day. I might drive it weekly or something like that because I walked everywhere around the campus.
Uh-huh.
And I go out to get my car, and I start looking, and I look, and I look, and I looked for several hours, and I could not find my car. I knew where I'd parked it. It wasn't there. It had been stolen.
Oh,
and so now I don't have a car to get to Grand Canyon. So my dad loaned me his 1964 or 65 black VW Bug. We took the front seat out, or the passenger seat out, and then I put all the junk in there I thought I would need for a summer, and away I went. And just this morning I was looking at some photographs here. I had a photograph of my granddad at the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
And he and my mom, the car was found in San Francisco, and they had stripped a bunch of stuff out of it, but it still worked. And so they drove that VW back to the Grand Canyon and exchanged it for my dad's VW, and then they drove back to the Bay Area. So
nice.
This took place in probably, I'm thinking in July, is when they, late July, when they found the car. So that was kind of a inauspicious beginning of my career at the canyon there. So,
You had a good fitting uniform, and that's
right.
That would.
And you know, I made $2.36 an hour. So, all that money went to keeping that uniform in good shape. I would go over to the Fred Harvey Laundry, and I would have them wash and press my shirts, and we had to wear, the uniform was awful to wear on the South Rim because it, you know, it gets 80, 85, maybe even 90 degrees up there.
Yep.
During the summer, and we had to wear the heavyweight wool pants, dress pants, with the Corfam Oxford shoes, and then the long sleeve shirt, and the felt premium beaver hat, and then we had an Ike jacket that we wore for evening or when it started to get cool. And so you were in a Class A, and you had to have your tie on, in a Class A uniform all the time, and it was in unair conditioned patrol cars going around, so it was pretty awful. But I think because I had to go through it throughout my career, I kind of insisted that my people, when they wanted to wear shorts, I said, well, you can wear shorts in the, when I was at Black Canyon, you wear shorts in the Black Canyon or when you're on a patrol boat.
Yeah.
But I did let them wear Levi's.
So do you remember the Fred Harvey Laundry? There was a woman mm-hmm. working there named Mary Hoover.
Oh, that name sounds familiar, but I don't know anything about her.
Okay.
Yeah.
And of course, Buford Bellegarde. These were people that were running.
Yeah, Buford Bellegarde. Uh huh.
Yep. Running the laundry. Who else did you make friends with that first summer there?
Mostly, the seasonal rangers that I worked with.
Who were they?
And then some of the permanent rangers. There was a group of permanent rangers that were actually intake rangers.
Okay.
That had come, that had just gone through the training center. They weren't necessarily new to the Park Service, but they were new to being permanent rangers.
So they'd gone through the Albright? Was that still at Albright?
Albright Training Center.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, Albright Training Center.
Because this would, and, hang on, I'm going to jump in here and ask for some clarification. The Yosemite, is it the Yosemite riots? This was the chief ranger at the time, I believe, was a guy named Richard Marks, and
mm-hmm.
I can't place that year wise. Was that this
that
was
71, I believe.
Okay, so it's coming up. It hasn't happened yet, and then,
it hasn't happened yet. No.
At this point, then, as a ranger. You mentioned being in a patrol car, but can you talk about the duties in that summer of 1969, the duties of your job?
Yeah, this, of course, I started on the South Rim rather than Phantom Ranch, so I was on the South Rim for that first year, from June 15th to about the 1st of November was the period of time I worked.
Okay.
And I had a bunch of, it was still kind of very much a generalist position. I started out probably one of the best jobs I ever had. It was called Rim Patrol.
Okay.
And they had to cancel that partway into the summer because they didn't have the funds to continue to do it. But what you would do, you had the task of walking from like Maricopa Point back all the way to Yavapai Museum. That was kind of your area of patrol, but mostly from the Bright Angel Trailhead over to Yavapai.
Okay.
And of course, most of the activity really was around the Bright Angel Lodge, the El Tovar Hotel,
right,
and all that area. And you just marched up and down there, and you know, it was kind of a meet and greet type position. There were lots of lost kids, and there were any issue that came up in the lodges.
Answered questions, pointed out geographical features.
Yeah, just you were sort of almost a naturalist, but still you were supposed to be, enforcing rules and regs, and any kind of life, health, safety issues that came up, you could deal with those. And that only lasted about 2 weeks. Then they kind of ran out of money, I guess, and I'm might have gone on one more pay period or so. And then I worked the entrance station for a while, and that was pretty brutal. It was fun in that you got to greet people and you got a lot of crazy questions and all that, but you inhaled all of that carbon monoxide all day.
Yeah.
And I remember going home with just absolute splitting headaches. And hopefully, design of entrance stations is a little better nowadays, where they have some kind of positive pressure in there to keep all that out of your nostrils, But I had lots of unusual contacts at the entrance station. It was a fun job if you let it be a fun job.
Tell me about it.
And, well, I had questions like, you'd have questions like, what time do they light the canyon at night? or what kind of uniforms do the cattle guards wear? And I had a guy come in one time, and he says, "Where's the dip?" D-I-P. "Where's the dip?" I said, "The what?" He said, "Where's the dip?" I said, "You mean the canyon?" He says, "Yeah, the dip." And I said, "Well, it's ahead. At this time, the entrance station was right where the service road is. It goes to the hospital clinic."
Right.
And it wasn't out where it is now. And so I said, "Well, it's 1 mile ahead." And he said, "Well, which side of the road's it on?" And I said, "Don't worry, you'll know it when you see it." You know.
Can you describe that building for me? Because this was, as you mentioned, this was up what's called Center Road.
Yeah, Center Road now.
Mm-hmm. And it was just where today's high school and school are. It was right near that intersection, I guess, of Albright. The Albright Training Center had been built, but new. And so how far were you from the Albright?
Probably the Inman station was on the main road.
Yep.
Right where you turn at Center there, I guess, you'd be turning to the left. And there were two buildings. One was sort of a permanent structure that was, two rooms, and it had a small bathroom, as I recall. Did it have a bathroom? No, it did not have a bathroom. It had two rooms. One was the contact area, and then the back room was where you could, kind of get away for a few minutes, and if you had to count money or those types of things.
Right.
And then the other booth was just a single kind of a box.
So there were two lanes then.
Yes, there were two lanes, and then they had this guardrail set up in front where they had metal posts into the ground to kind of protect the buildings from oncoming traffic.
Sure.
And also separate the lanes. And the buses would go along around the far building, and then cars and even motorhomes could come through between the two buildings. And that was the main building was used most of the time. And one of the funny things they had is they had this safe in there, and this thing was huge. I mean, it must have weighed 1,000 pounds and had a big steel door on it. And when I first got there, they had a pistol in there.
Hmm.
And in case we got robbed, and then someone realized that they have this pistol in there, but they've got people that are not trained to use it. A lot of the people that were working the entrance station and probably never shot a gun, so they thought that's probably not a good thing. So they took that out after a while, and we just use the safe for what it's usually intended for, to put the remittances and those types of things in.
So, I'm just thinking about now. If you did need to go to the bathroom down Center, if you walk down Center, the gas station was down there. Is that right?
Well, that's quite a ways down. Yeah,
that was a ways down. Okay.
The entrance station's at least it's almost a mile from the, or half mile anyway, from the clinic or the
from the park headquarters,
and then the high school and all that.
Where the store was. So it's a ways out. Okay.
It's quite a ways.
Huh.
I don't remember what the bathroom situation was. I think there was a little outhouse in the woods there or something that we used.
And you were responsible for your cash drawer, which in later years would become quite the issue. People needed to be financially responsible for large amounts of money.
That's right. There was some shenanigans going on. One man, I won't tell you his name, he was the lead fee collector, and he told us, he said, we were to take money. They had an old vacuum cleaner in there, and it had a bag in it, and so if we had an overage, he told us, take the money from the overage and put it in that vacuum cleaner bag. You had the inner and outer bag. You put the money between the two bags, and we were kind of dumb and thought, well, that's a good idea. Then you use that money. If you had an underage, then you could take the money and make sure your receipts balanced out.
Uh-huh.
And then you didn't have to fill out a bunch of other paperwork and stuff. And the only problem that I heard was happening is that amount of impress cash, so to speak, would disappear. And this guy finally...
Yeah, the janitors at night that would turn on the vacuum cleaner and go, "Hey, look at this!"
Yeah, look at this. Wow. Uh-huh. But But eventually, someone found out that he was skimming the till, so to speak, and I think he went to jail for it. So
yeah,
that was a year or two later.
Okay,
might have been even after I left.
And how long?
The buildings were kind of a desert pink color, horrible looking color.
Oh wow!
They painted them.
Were they part of the Mission 66 building?
What's that?
Were they part of the Mission 66 construction?
They could have been, but they weren't very big. I mean, they weren't very large buildings. They're quite small.
And did you have a door? Would you walk right out to the people, or were you sitting on a chair and spun around to a little window?
You had a window.
Okay.
You had a window, yeah. And then the exit door was on the outbound traffic lane side.
Okay. So you could.
If you had to actually go out and talk to somebody outside, you had to go clear around the building. You
know, right.
And whatnot. But one of the interesting things that would happen is that there were two things. One is that in those days we let foreign tourists into the park for free.
Oh.
If you were from a foreign country, you got in free. It was some sort of promotion that either Grand Canyon Park was doing, or the Southwest or Western region was doing, or the National Park Service was doing as a whole. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we let all the foreign tourists in, and of course nowadays we're paying the price for that because they love the park, you know, almost more than Americans do, you know. So as far as crowding, that's who a lot of the folks are. And then another interesting thing would happen is the Navajo Indians or other Indian groups would come in to the entrance station, and I always remember they would come up, and there were several of them. I saw them repeated several times, the same group, but they would stop at the entrance station, and they would not look at you. They would look straight ahead, and you would say, $7, please, and they wouldn't say anything, wouldn't move. You would say, $7, please, and then finally I'd say, oh, go on in, you know, and they'd take off. So they were people that were using the park as an access probably to go to Cameron rather than going the longer way around.
Well, also, weren't there Native Americans living in Supai Camp at the time?
Well, they were, but they would have stickers and stuff on their cars, see, and these were unmarked cars, so
okay.
They were just they might have been visiting, you know. And of course, if you were a visitor to someone who lived in the park, you didn't have to pay to enter to the park anyway. So,
right.
But, you know, you do have a communications problem with foreign visitors and and sometimes with American Indians.
I see. Okay. And so this was, it was only a couple of weeks. So by into July, that you were sent out to the entrance station. Is that right?
Seems like that. Yeah, I was at the entrance station, at least several tours, and then I was also doing both daytime and nighttime. Well, I didn't do nighttime patrols till a little later on, but I did a lot of campground, also had campground patrol, and I like that. You got to talk to a lot of the people, and you get the campground organized, you know, get people out of the dirt and onto the asphalt pads and whatnot.
Okay.
And we had a few people that were problematic. I remember we had one guy that was, he had taken a cable and hooked into the electric system on one of the bathrooms and had a light bulb in his tent. And he was a guy that was, and he was kind of a violent individual, and they were trying to catch him I remember we went over to his tent, we found the light bulb and everything, we couldn't find him. And then he showed up at the camper service, and he was jumping over the turnstile or whatever to get in to take a shower without paying. And the Fred Harvey manager called on him, and we finally, you know, took him to jail. So he finally And then we went over and disconnected his electrical system. And
what do you recall about the jail at the time and the judge at the time?
The jail was located down near where the old warehouse and the paint shop and the farrier, the blacksmith shop was. It was a little small building. It's still there. I saw it here a few weeks ago when I was up at the canyon. And it was just a two-room affair. It had kind of a foyer area that went clear across the building. And then the jail cell was on the right. It was just a single cell. It was painted this awful green color. And I think there was a little desk with a light out in the foyer area, and then the cell itself was pretty Spartan, you know. It had a toilet and a little bed, and that was about it, and lots of graffiti on the walls. And there was one little, I think there was one window in the jail cell that was barred up, and they did have, after I left, they had a guy break out of there by the his buddies came. They broke into the blacksmith shop, got some tools, went over, took the screen off of the window, and broke him out. And eventually, they were picked up in New Mexico or something and returned to the park. And they got time served or something like that. We weren't very happy about it. But there was a United States magistrate. Oh boy. Trying to remember his name now. We called him Mumbles, I remember. But I can't remember his real name.
And did he mumble?
And he mumbled, yeah. And then there was later on, there was a Justice of the Peace, Morrill Roberts was his name. And he handled state cases, and we were all, you know, later on, after you got trained a little bit, deputized by Coconino County. And so you could write a state ticket and go before the Justice of the Peace. And then for most of our cases, though, we went before the U.S. Magistrate.
What else do you remember about Mumbles?
Well, he had a large nose and was very red, and we always accused him of being an alcoholic. And then it seemed hypocritical that he was passing judgment on drunk drivers when he had a serious issue himself.
Well, did he, or did he just have a red nose?
he was still you know, pretty fair, and he didn't favor necessarily one side or the other, but I had several cases before him, and I was pretty satisfied with the judgments, you know.
Okay, I mean it's interesting because it would seem as though, how did his housing work?
Well, he lived in park housing.
Okay.
And had a wife and daughter, and I don't know how they, there was probably just an exchange of money between agencies, you know, the judicial
between Department of Justice
and the Park Service, I'm guessing, uh-huh, you know, because uh-huh. There were a lot of people that lived in park housing over the years that weren't park employees, you know.
Right, and certainly you guys would have been working closely with him. And the offenders were sort of a revolving door, if you will, of just people that would come and go.
Yeah, pretty much. Although probably the biggest problem that you have is that the majority of the violators were concession employees.
Ooh.
We had the most trouble with concession employees. The most serious offenses were usually with concession employees.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's something that's kind of forgotten, I think. You think of, you know, the park visitors being the bad guys, where it really is a lot of problems with concession. And part of it had to do with the hiring practices of Fred Harvey and probably others, in that they don't pay that well, and they get people that are just transient. Anyway, you show up and you ask for a job, and they would give them a job. You know, you could be a dishwasher or something. And the way they would handle it is that people would go down to the Fred Harvey General offices. They'd get a fingerprint card. They'd come up to the district ranger office, and then we would fingerprint them. That was another one of my jobs.
Hmm.
And you would fingerprint individuals, and they'd send those cards off to the FBI. And then they would come back. Sometimes it wasn't a very fast process, so it might be a month or more. And then you would get the rap sheet on some of these people, and there were some really bad actors. I remember one Ken Hulick and I were out patrolling late at night, and this guy, we're sitting at the stop sign at Center Street or near there where we could observe the stop sign, and this guy blew through the stop sign, and we stopped him, and I think Ken wrote him a ticket, and the guy was, had been convicted of manslaughter and all kinds
wow.
of bad stuff, you know, so there were really some bad people. Now, as a general rule, they weren't, but there were always a few in there that were not good people. I got ready to go over and get a haircut one time, my first summer. I remember my boss says, Bob says, your hair is getting too long. You need to get your hair cut by on your next day's off. I said, okay. I said, where's a good place to go? He said, well, why don't you go over to the Bright Angel Lodge? There's a barber over there. His name's Chet. And you can get a haircut, and you'll be all fixed up. Okay. So I go over to the Bright Angel Lodge on my day off, and I go to the barber shop, and the barber shop's closed. So I go to the main bellhop there, and I said, what's the deal with the barber shop? Why is it closed? And they said, well, the barber found out the sheriff was after him, and he split town. So I had to go to Williams to get my haircut.
Oh, my gosh.
I got a terrible haircut, came back, and my boss said, oh, you look great, Bob. Another job that I had that first summer we were talking about was the midnight to 8 shift. And that was really brutal for me. I've never been one that, you know, I like 10:30, I like to go to sleep,
mm-hmm.
get up early, and that's kind of my biological clock, you know. And but I had to work midnight to 8, and your job was to go to the South Rim District office there, which is the big log building near the old Babbitt store and post office. I forget what it's. I think it's a little community center maybe now. It's kind of at the crossroads.
It's still Ranger Operations. Actually, they may have moved out.
Yeah, there, Ranger Operations.
Yeah,
and that's also where the U.S. Magistrate and the Justice of the Peace had their offices there.
So hang on a second.
It was in that building.
Let's talk about just locations and geography for a minute here. The park headquarters for many years was that log building. And across the street from that to the west was the Babbitt store, the general store.
Right.
And just further west of that was the post office.
Correct.
And so then eventually the post office became the magistrate's courthouse.
Uh-huh.
And the administration, park headquarters, was moved over by the Shrine of the Ages in that area. So when you were there in 69, what was still the lay of the land? Where was park headquarters?
Well, the Babbitt store was in the location that you mentioned.
Okay.
And the post office was functioning.
Right.
The parking lot in front of both of them.
Right next to it.
And then across the street was They called it the South Rim District Ranger Office.
Okay.
And it was also, that was the downstairs, and then upstairs there were some, there were a couple of rooms that we used, or Rangers used upstairs. But then there were the basically the courtrooms for the magistrate and the justice of the peace in that building.
Okay.
And then so Fred Harvey office. I'm sorry. What?
So Mumbles would have been in there. That was his office.
Mumbles
up there?
Was up there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And Judge Morrell. Let's see. What did I say his name was? Morrell Roberts was his name.
Yeah. Is that there. Is that Morrell Roberts?
Morrell, I believe, or M O R no one R M O R E L L I believe. I don't know why I can't remember the magistrate's name, but I can't. So.
Well, maybe we'll talk again, and you can.
But and then you know, the other, the rest of the residences and stuff were up, kind of to the south, the high school, to the southwest there, and
so the park headquarters,
the shop, and a
right.
lot of it's very similar. The training center, and. Is across from the maintenance yard, and
got it.
And there were a series of apartments. That was where I first lived, was in the training center apartments, because they weren't being used by the training center at the time, and the park would use that as housing.
That they were two-story apartments, and you were probably
right.
one of the upstairs or downstairs apartments on the
right.
far west end,
yeah.
far west wing there.
Right, and then later on, I in the fall when the trainees arrived. I moved to what was called a transa home, and when I drove by a couple weeks ago there, it wasn't there anymore, and it was kind of a modular trailer type affair. They had five of us in it, five guys in there in this little thing. We all had different jobs. Some of them were trail crew, and some of them were something else, and I was a park ranger, so we would get up at different hours, and everybody would gripe about everybody else, you know, getting up and making a lot
making
of noise.
Making noise, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it was crazy. And then later on, I moved up to Hermit Circle to a little apartment, and that was all just within that one season there. I had three different places.
Wow, and but the Hermit Circle apartment, that was a huge step up. I mean, it seems like the Albright apartments were better than the Trader. But the Hermit Circle apartment was better than Albright.
yeah, that's right.
Moving
it
up
was,
the line.
It was pretty, you know, it was nice, it was comfortable, but it was very small. When you pulled the hide-a-bed out, there went your living room, you know. It was gone.
Yep. Yeah.
They weren't huge, that's for sure.
Right.
But
right.
Anyway, I had this, we were talking about this midnight day shift. You want
yeah.
to go back to that?
Yeah, yeah.
That was really a hard job for me, because I really... I'm not good at the all night stuff. I, you know, I can go till 1 or 2 in the morning and I'm okay, but then it gets really brutal. And one of the reasons they had night shift is that they had another shift that really went all night. They think they had a 1 till 1 o'clock, and then they had another one that went. I think there was a break there. And then someone came on early, like at 6 o'clock or something. So there was a break in time. So they didn't have 24-hour road patrol, unless there was something going on, obviously, and then the ranger would stay out. But they also had a thing called a fire phone, and they had this big Claxton under the desk of the ranger that was on duty there. And if someone called in on the fire phone, this big Claxton went off, and it would just, you know, make you bounce off the ceiling. And you were then instructed, if that happened, there was a call list, and you would call various people.
Okay.
So we'd get the fire brigade out and deal with whatever was going on.
So this was sort of dispatch as well.
You were sort of a dispatcher, yeah, is what it amounted to, but there was not a whole lot of dispatching going on
right.
after about 1 or 1 in the morning or so.
Yeah.
And then if something happened, I remember Vic Vieira one time, he had a drunk, and dad that he'd stopped over by the superintendent's house, and he needed he knew the guy and knew he was going to have trouble, so he called me as backup. And so I locked up the building, put the fire phone on. There was a switch you could turn to put it into someone else's house.
Mm.
And I drove over there and helped him drag this guy to jail. But and that happened several times where I had to lock the building up and go out. And it was usually if it happened during that window where no one else was on, then you know you would lock if it was, you felt it was serious enough, you'd lock the building up and go out. And,
right.
And we had a lot of a lot of drunkenness there and stuff, both drunk drivers and then the people passed out in their cars and rowdy behavior in the bars and those types of things we had to
uh-huh.
deal with. And they even got called out to Tucson to assist out there with the county and stuff on occasion. So,
right.
But the midnight date was really hard for me. I remember I couldn't sleep during the day, and I would go for two or three days
oh, wow.
with little to no sleep, and then the third day I would come home and crash, and when it would get to be, I'd set my clock. You know, if I got home at 8:30, I would set the clock for 8 o'clock that night, and then I would wake up, shut the clock off, reset it for like 11:30,
wow.
and then wake back up, put my uniform on, grab a bite to eat, and go back to work. And it was really, I just wasn't built for that type of work.
Yeah.
But I remember we had troubles getting new hires, and they had several times where they, particularly in the spring, the following spring, where people were supposed to show up for work and either didn't show up or showed up and left, and myself and a couple other guys kept having to pull midnight to 8 shift, you know, for it seemed like forever there. But the other jobs I had that first summer were to go on patrol, and usually you patrolled the village, the south entrance. We went out to Duck on the Rock, I think, is where the district boundary was with the Desert View District.
Okay.
And so you would just drive around and, get out, check the lodges and check viewpoints. And you could go out on the what we call the West Rim Drive at that time. I think it's called the Hermit Rest Road.
That's right.
We would go out there on occasion, but we were kind of told, don't go too far out on the West Rim Drive because if something happens in the village,
you can't get back.
You're the only one on.
Yeah.
It's going to take you forever to get back. And
it just seems like a terribly difficult job to stay awake at. There's not much happening, and
The midnight to 8 job.
Yeah,
job
yeah.
Was.
The midnight.
It was brutal. Yeah, that one guy would put a. He had a big fire poker, and he'd put it up against the door, and then go into the had a little rescue cache off of the lobby there, and he'd go in there and sleep. And the district ranger got wind of that, and one night he comes in and opens the door, and this big fireplace poker falls
to the ground.
Door,
right.
And the guy comes sleepily walking out of the rescue cache, and well, you can imagine what the end result of that was.
Oops. Yeah, yeah.
So,
Bob, we have been...
The district ranger was a guy named Vernon Roosh, and he was...
How do you spell Vernon's last name? R-U-S-C-H?
R-U-E-S-C-H, I believe.
Okay.
He transferred to Alaska... after the first like month and a half that I was there, and the assistant, there was an assistant district ranger. Oh boy, I thought I'd never forget his name. Nick Nicholson was his name. Nick Nicholson was the assistant district ranger. He then became the acting district ranger. And the thing about Nick. He liked to put notes up. memos. He would write memos about everything. He wouldn't talk to people. He just put memos up. So you had to check even change the schedule.
Oh, my gosh.
The schedule. And if you're on your days off and you didn't call in, you might get in trouble for not being on duty, you know, because he'd change the schedule on you. And it was it was difficult to work under him.
So Bob, what I'm gonna do right now is I think let's wrap up part two, because we've been at this a little over an hour and a half, and it's amazing how time flies. I got a ton of more questions for you about Nick, and about Ken Hulick, and the guy that hired you as well.
Dick McLaren.
Dick McLaren, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So if that's all right with you, let's look at doing a part three. This is great. Is there anything else? You're like, wait a minute, I want to finish that story, or are we good to wrap up for part two?
Well, the only other thing would be other employees maybe that were around that first season.
There absolutely.
Were three intakes I had talked to you about. There was a guy named Carl Duhan.
How do you spell Carl's last name?
Duhan. There was a Jim Cutler. And there was a last name of McLeod. I'll think about it. I remember these were all Ranger intakes that were sort of permanent, getting ready to be reassigned to other parks.
Okay.
And McLeod ended up, he was the only one that didn't go on to further Park Service. He quit because he didn't like his second assignment, and someone always told me he always was sort of dreaming about the getting paid in sunsets and riding off into the sunset, you know, or something. But it just wasn't quite his cup of tea, you know, when he finally.
Well, let's talk about Carl and Jim as well when we pick this back up again. Also,
right,
Nick and Vernon and Dick. As
there
long
was
as
some other,
Ken.
There was a Jim Vukinich was another park ranger.
Well, also, Warren Miller. No, I'm sorry. Not Warren Miller, but Warren Hill would have been around at the time, and possibly Vanderlippe. Do those names ring?
Warren Hill was the became the river manager when they went to the management system.
Right. And of course, Superintendent Lovegren. So there's a number of people that I'm like, wait a minute, I want to ask you about all this stuff. Let's wrap this up now, and we will pick this up at another time. So hold the line for a minute. This is the end of part two, Grand Canyon Oral History with Bob Cornelius, and today is May 31st, 2018, and so hang on, Bob.
Okay.